Well, the world's most technologically advanced exploration ship sails on a mission that may reveal the origin of life on Earth. It's a Japanese ship intending to drill 4.3 miles below the seabed, more than three times deeper than has been done before. It will then raise to the surface a cylinder about 5 feet long, which could contain science's first glimpse of a living sample of the Earth's mantle. The ship will also be conducting research into the origin of earthquakes by sinking sensors beneath the Earth's crust. Scientists aboard that ship want to provide Japan and East Asia with the first effective earthquake prediction system. Well, we have our own earthquake prediction system. It's called the Stan Dale. So we'll be back with Stan and his wife Holly in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, as Stan would tell me, George, introduce Holly first, so I shall. Holly Drennan Dale graduated from the University of Missouri in Kansas City with a Bachelor of Arts degree in English and understudies in sociology and geology. And although very first love was writing and research, this career was interrupted in order to run a family business for 14 years. Determined to put homemaking on the front burner, Holly retired and embarked upon preparedness research. In addition, Holly has authored Dare to Prepare, a 500-page reference book on preparedness. Holly Dale. Hi, Holly. How are you?
Good evening, George. Thanks for the opportunity to help get people prepared.
Likewise. By the way, thank you for the autographed book. And I've got to tell you, your penmanship has got to be the best I've ever seen.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, are you looking at mine?
Are you a calligrapher?
Not at all.
My God, it's phenomenal. You really are good. And of course, your husband, Stan Dale, has held above top secret security clearance, worked undercover for the FBI. He was part of an exclusive black project headed by Dr. Edward Teller, specializing in the development of flying saucer technology. Stan has lectured on many world events, which include the coming global economic collapse, developing solar-related crises in the Earth's climate, the UFO deception, its real intent, suppression of badly needed technologies, and high-voltage physics of cheaper energy. Both Stan and Holly will be our complete guests tonight in Coast to Coast. Hi, Stan.
Hey,
welcome back.
Buenas noches, Senor George.
Hey, you looked great on the Predictions television show.
I'd like to see that. We don't have cable here. We're a little bit out in the country.
Maybe I can get you a DVD. I'll see what I can do.
Great stuff.
Hey, Stan, I want to take just a couple minutes to chat with you, and Holly, jump in anytime you want. I have never seen in the years... couple of years I've been talking with you, Stan. I've never asked you about this flying saucer technology and what your role was and what was going on. Can you brief us a little bit on this? Because this is an incredible story all by itself. We won't have a lot of time to talk about it, but I am curious. What was that?
Well, I was recruited into the program in Dallas in 1971 by Dr. Teller's man, James R. Maxfield, Dr. Maxfield. They had a guy that was close to me in the company where I was working in the computer industry, and I used to have coffee with him, and I didn't realize who I was talking to. It kind of makes you cautious these days, but yeah. Anyway, I was just having a cup of talk with this guy. He's an older man, and he asked what I was doing, and I told him about some stuff I was doing at home and researching a new way to make an aircraft, using a very tricky concept to make it go faster and speed of sound without making a shockwave and all that kind of junk. Anyway, this got their ear, and I guess they looked into my lab to see what I was doing at home when I wasn't there. And I had a meeting with Dr. Maxfield there in Dallas at his request, and he told me about the project about 50 projects, actually, that he and Dr. Edward Teller had supervised in the United States since about the mid-50s. And some of them were aircraft, plasma craft, and some of them were actually, in the later days, anti-gravity craft. And they wanted me to join their program and go down to Australia to finish my work. In retrospect, I think it was probably just to keep me from saying too much in the press and, mm-hmm. and applying for a patent and letting the cat out of the bag. Because there is a secret to this kind of propulsion that works in water, in space, magnetic fields, and gravitational fields. And most of you have seen it. If you've ever blown a smoke ring or seen somebody blowing a smoke ring, that's the secret behind being able to go faster than the wave velocity in whatever you're traveling in, like faster than the speed of light, faster than the speed of sound. And so that was what I was recruited to do, was to develop papers on that and drawings with that technology in mind. Now, my particular approach to the problem was using charged high-temperature air and high-voltage direct currents over a saucer-shaped craft. Those type of craft, I came to find out later, had already been developed by these guys in the late 50s, and they had solved a lot of the problems that I hadn't even foreseen, like seals, the seals at the top of the catching fire.
Was it based on reverse-engineered craft? I mean, did they actually have something that they found, crashed, confiscated from up there?
Well, let me say, I never saw it, and to my knowledge, I never met any of the aliens. But the rumor market inside the organization was, yes, they did. And the anti-gravity side of it is probably more of what they back-engineered, because what I was talking about was an extension of probably German technology that they would have picked up after World War II with the paperclip boys that they brought into the country.
Now, that's a whole show one day, Stan. We've got to get you back for that.
All right, we'll Absolutely. Put up some pictures of some of the test models and stuff I've got here, the air
Fascinating.
Thing, you can see that.
Okay, you and Holly have been working on preparedness, Holly especially, over the last number of years. And, Stan, of course, what you do is you've been pretty accurate over the years when you look at earth changes and earthquakes. And with some of the work that Holly does, you've combined both of that. Holly, the preparedness based on earth changes, earthquakes, volcanoes, and also man-made disasters. How did you decide, you know what, I better take my career in that direction?
Growing up in the Midwest, we went through ice storms, tornadoes, blizzards, power outages, and at least two floods. That was many, many years ago. And through those times, the weather has only increased in its unpredictability and is really scary changes. So we were not LDS or anything, but we lived at the bottom of a six-block hill, and there was a storm drain that ran the entire length of this six-block area. And when it rained really hard in Kansas City, that storm drain oftentimes couldn't contain it.
Right, backed up.
Right. Well, my mother always kept extra things, particularly her favorite peanut butter and chocolate and flour and toilet paper and all the things that you need to have on hand to get you through emergencies. Now, my dad used to pick on her unmercifully, just tease her, saying, oh, gee, you know, we'll never need this, and, you know, what do you got down in your little rabbit squirrel nest and so forth.
Yeah.
Well, about the first time we had a power outage, and she brought out our goodies, and we were all, you know, living quite fine in the power outage, he kind of quit ribbing her so much. So that was the start of it right there. We saw firsthand how these things that weren't fancy saw us through, and we were fine.
Well, and you're right. These changes, particularly earth changes, are dramatic, and they're so intense now. I mean, storms years ago that, you know, were bad, have been magnified 10 times. And you're right. They get worse, not better. So I guess for you, Stan Dale, what the heck is happening on the planet?
Well, a number of things. From a purely meteorological and geological point of view, I think the great majority of the global warming effect we're seeing is coming from the sun itself and from natural sources of carbon dioxide and methane gas in the plants and animal life of the planet. However, this is a cycle, and I've analyzed the cycle. In fact, on our website, if you go to our front page and get inside there,
standale.com.
Yeah, you'll click on it, and as you get into the site, there's in the upper right-hand corner, or right in front of you, actually, it says Coast to Coast AM Show Topics. If you click on that, you'll see some really interesting graphics and stories that are put in there about what we're talking about. One of them is the global warming and the sunspot minimum cycle. Now, I haven't ever heard anybody say anything about this, but it doesn't mean that other scientists haven't put this, this thought together. But global temperatures, say, from 1860 to 2004, which is what we have the record for, are on an upward spiral from about minus 0.4 up to about 0.5 degrees centigrade on the planet. Now, that's horrific movements of temperature on a planetary basis. Now, what I discovered is that people look at sunspot cycles, you know, the number of sunspots we have every 11.8 years,
mm-hmm.
how high those peaks get, and count, you know, the 300, that's a high number, and then 200, not so high. Okay, well, those follow kind of sinusoidal, you know, kind of a peaky-looking curve on the graph every 11.8 years. But what people weren't looking at was the little bitty humps in between the tall peaks, you know, the low times, about five and a half to 6 years into the cycle, there aren't very many sunspots at all, and so it gets low. Now, very seldom do you get zero sunspots in a year or in a month.
Right.
So what I did, I was looking at this one day, and I looked at the graph of the global temperatures on the Earth going up, and I looked at the tops of the low points of all of these, you know, in between all of these high sunspot figures, and I saw that graph followed the same kind of curve as the global temperature curve. Now, what that means is this. The sun itself, in its off peak, when it's not having so many sunspots,
right.
is generating heat. You know, something is generating heat on Earth at that time to us, and I don't know whether it's particular wavelengths. You know, it's not always the magnetic storms, because they kind of back off at that time. But you know, it's definitely correlating to the not so many sunspot periods, and we also see increases in earthquakes on the Earth as it slides down in every cycle from the high number down to the low number.
Do you think the sun, Stan, might be the major source of these horrendous changes on the planet? Then
I do. Now, that's the source of the energy. The trapping of the energy is still there's still a lot of argument about whether human involvement and animal life and plant life are releasing gases to trap that energy. But we're not producing our energy problem. We're just trapping the energy in greenhouse gases. You know, only 2% of the greenhouse gases on the planet come from human activity. 98% come from natural sources.
And that's always been the case, hasn't it?
I mean,
in recent times, I mean, if we go back, let's say, 200 years, wouldn't you say that the Earth changes were still primarily the cause of any kind of global warming?
I would think so. I mean, we haven't really become industrialized until the last 100 years.
Right.
And I agree. There's an interesting statistic, which you can see on the website there, about the level of the jump in sea level in geological time when humans appeared on the scene. And if you look back over 120,000 years, about 120,000 years ago, the sea level was a little bit lower than it is now, but then on just a straight 45-degree angle going down to when mankind appeared on the scene,
mm-hmm.
The sea level dropped to almost, you know, zilch. And then when man appeared on the scene, zoom, it shot up just almost straight up as mankind appeared. Now, it might have been done for us. Somebody may have engineered the planet, you know, like God, to make the sea level rise for our benefit. I don't know, but it just shoots up like a rocket. When you see the graph on the page, you see what I'm talking about. It's just straight up. And then it started to peak off. Toward modern times, just started to drop again.
Is it just a strange cycle?
Well, you know, I think things are cyclical. You know, the planets orbit with a period, a cycle. The sun goes through cycles. All stars go through cycles. Now, ours may be doing something like a top winding down that is causing us grief and is going to cause us more grief by putting out more heat, possibly throwing out some particles and stuff in storms here the next 5-6 years, that will give us real grief.
I've always believed we're in a cycle, except that we contribute to the speed of the cycle. I don't believe mankind is responsible for global warming. I believe we're helping to contribute to what was going to happen anyway.
Oh, I think so. And the thing that's the wild card is, you know, science that we use here on the Earth about anything, we say, well, let's see what's happened in the past in cycles of whatever we're talking mm-hmm. about, and therefore it will happen that way again, except when it doesn't. And the cycle with the sun at the moment, we can't be sure that what we've seen it do, you know, in 500-year increments and 1,000-year increments is going to happen this time the same way, because the sun is getting older and it's more of its hydrogen fuel is burned up, and there are circumstances changing, which we noticed in 1991 when it started emitting two brand new ultraviolet frequencies that we'd never seen come out of it, which indicates something unusual has happened to the nuclear chemistry there. So it's cyclical, but we may be starting a new series of cycles of something that's unpleasant.
Holly, Stan has been looking at earthquake forecasting for a number of years now. I'm going to ask you, because you live with the guy, where does he get his abilities to do that? You would not call him a psychic, right?
No, it's hard science. He takes the Navy data from CENMOC and has developed a software program where he changes the information numerically and figures the earthquakes there. I think he's mentioned before on your show that he looks for rapidly cooling areas placed immediately next to rapidly heating areas, and where these touch over a fault, they normally convert within 1 to 5 days to a quake.
Have you ever seen him really concerned about some of the things he sees?
Absolutely. The most concerned I ever saw him was about 2 weeks prior to the Indonesian quake that happened on December 26th.
Mm-hmm.
And he was posting notices daily on his concerns about this. And finally, he just had to go to air. He says, I do not understand this. There is something really weird going on. And if I didn't know better, he says, we're going to have a tremendous release. Well, we did 4 days later. And you know what happened with that quake.
Absolutely. Stan, what was it you saw?
Well, I saw a huge signal like Holly was talking about, where it's a sudden cooling and a sudden heating up across a fault line. But this wasn't just a fault line. This was a tectonic plate which Australia and New Zealand sit on, and it butts up into Indonesia. It's called the Australian-Indian plate. And the thing lasted, like it didn't happen like normal ones go for 24 hours and then disappear. This signal lasted for 10 to 12 days, and it got stronger and stronger and bigger, stretching around the edge of the tectonic plate. Now, the major part of the signal was over through New Zealand, and it was, as I recall, it was getting, it was getting colder on the Australian side of New Zealand and the tectonic plate there. And it was putting huge pressures on the plate simply because the water was heavier on that side because it was cooler. And so I thought, well, now, is it going to break in the middle of Australia? Is it going to break up on the Asian thing up where all the volcanoes are through Sumatra and you know, Jakarta way there, where Krakatoa is? And all I knew, I couldn't pinpoint a location because it was such a huge signal. And you don't see these very often, thank goodness, but... So that's why I went out and said, look, you know, I hope people listen that there's something happening somewhere along that whole fault line.
Was it so big prior to, did you think, no, it can't be?
Yep. I was hesitant to say anything, but then I thought, boy, if I'm right and I don't say anything,
right,
I'm going to feel guilty as all get out.
Stay with us. Stan and Holly Dayar, I guess we'll talk a little bit more about some of these earth changes that affect all of us. And then we'll get right into preparedness. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Hey, have you been curious about StreamLink Coast to Coast AM subscription service? Well, we're really happy to announce that we're kicking off 2006 with a free weekend just for you, just to try out a truly remarkable value. The free weekend will run this Friday, okay? This Friday, January 20th through Sunday the 22nd. Streamlink is a treasure trove for any Coast to Coast AM fan. It allows you to listen to and collect the last 3 months' worth of shows for just pennies a day. And users can download and burn MP3s of any of the last 90 days of shows so that you could take Coast to Coast on the go and listen at your leisure on both CD and MP3 players. The package also includes weekly classic shows from the vaults, permanent audio clips from all shows, the dynamic Coast Writers message board, live chat sessions with me and special guests. Mark your calendar for the Friday, the January 20th, this Friday, and get ready to experience the fun and terrific value of Streamlink. Check coasttocoastam.com starting on Tuesday for further details about the free weekend. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Stan and Holly Dale as we talk about preparedness. Stan, what do you see on the earthquake chart these days? Are you making any predictions?
Well, I do them every day. I publish the maps usually by about 5 o'clock Mountain Standard Time. What I have been seeing is a long-term buildup of pressures on the Australian Indian Plate again.
Again, same place.
Yep. But it's exactly opposite pressures to the way it was. It's warmer pressures in between Australia and New Zealand, which is tilting the plate up on that side instead of down.
Now, what does that mean?
That means it's probably going to break in a different place, probably either in the middle of Australia or up in New Guinea and west of there into the Malacca Sea.
Is it as looking as big as what you saw in December?
Almost. It's probably about 75% of that, but it's waxing and waning, like that signal we saw coming out from the west coast of the United States along the Mendocino Fault region here back in August. Right now, if you look on my map, you'll see 5 days' worth of warning circles all over New Zealand. And, of course, New Zealand's converting. They're having 4.6s and 5.2 earthquakes. They've been busy for the last 10 days. There is stress on that point, and this is dangerous because in the North Island of New Zealand, there is a huge pressure valve called Lake Taupo, or the caldera of Taupo, and it has three volcanoes on the edge of it, and it itself is a large volcano that erupted in 85 A.D., causing 3 days of darkness in China, for crying out loud, after it ejected all the stuff in the air.
Oh,
so if that goes, the shock waves and tsunamis and stuff will hit the entire Pacific Basin, and where it's positioned is such that we could see a lot of it hit Southern California, just smack straight on.
You were telling me about the possibilities of some problems near Seattle as well. What's happening there?
Well, it's been very quiet. There's a number of us that are taking different methods scientifically to look at when the quakes are going to occur. They've all gone quiet is all I can say. Is right now there's this terrible pause in all of our data all along the West Coast, and it's got us all kind of scratching our head. We may be in for a relaxing time for 2 or 3 months, and then it may come back with a fury, but we know that it's due very soon from what I've seen earlier in the year and late last year. For the past month, I'd say, the Juan de Fuca plate, which ties in from Seattle down to Mendocino, it's just been very quiet. But when it does go off, when we do get the earthquake there, and this is the only part of the Great Ring of Fire around the Pacific that hasn't had a major release in 50 years, and it's the same kind of pressure, same type of fault that it went off in Sumatra last year. Yeah, and when it goes off, if it produces tsunamis, certainly along the Oregon coast, there's going to be virtually no warning before it hits. I mean, 30 minutes possibly at the most. And people just won't be able to get out of the way on the shore. In Seattle, it's probably going to be shielded a bit because you have to go around and turn a corner. They have done studies of that, a certain type of tsunami, maybe from Alaska, could go slipping right in there and give Tacoma and Seattle a bit of a problem. But fortunately, the governments in those areas, the state governments and city governments, have been preparing and emergency services since, you know, a number of these disasters have been happening over the last year. And certainly since you and I have talked on the show here,
right.
I think it's waked them. We've seen a number of newspaper articles where local governments are getting things done. And I'm so glad for that, because some of the damage, some of the death can be avoided just by some careful preparation by the government.
They're starting to take this really seriously now, where in years gone past, you know, it was hit and miss.
Yeah, yeah. I look, up in San Francisco, they've got a problem that I don't know how they're going to solve with the levees up there. I mean, they've got thousands of miles of old levees, some of them 100 years old. And in 2004, one of them just spontaneously broke. They don't even know why. And it cost $100 million to repair the damage it did.
Oh, my God.
Now, then, they say to refurbish the major portions of those levees that are out there, it will cost $4 billion to do that. Where are they going to get the money for that?
They don't have that kind of money, which I guess leads us into you, Holly. What have we learned, if anything, from these horrible tragedies that hit us last year?
Well, some very important lessons. First and foremost, weather is getting more and more violent and unpredictable. And to that, I'm going to take a little sidestep here, if you'll permit me, to show your audience how things have increased, like the birth pangs. You know, NOAA keeps track of all of our immense costing disasters that are weather-related. And just since 1980, we have had 62 of these horrific events in America. Now, these things can be way over a billion or at least a billion. But all of these 62 disasters have totaled over $260 billion. That is not counting Katrina and Rita and the rest of everything that happened in 2005. Now, 53 of these $62 billion weather events happened just since 1988. That is 85% of everything. Seven of these hit in 1998 alone. We absolutely got pelted by that El Nino. And that El Nino, Stan found in his FENMOC maps and began warning way before its occurrence. At that time, we were down in Australia, and he saw this tremendous pattern building across the equator. And he went on with Art Bell and spoke of this several times before the event, warning people to get ready, get ready, get ready. There is something ugly on the horizon.
How many people actually take heed?
Not nearly enough. We have today, after Katrina, after Rita, after Ivan, and all of the rest of these horrific events we've had, Newsweek is currently taking a live vote poll, and 36% of all the people that voted said they felt they were well-equipped and prepared. 55 said, nope, not prepared, and 10 didn't know, and 9 didn't know.
See, and I would even think that 36% that says they're well-prepared, I would guess that would be high. I don't think it even is that percent. I think it's even lower.
It probably is, because once you get in the midst of a disaster, you remember everything you wished you had done, or you find out what you should have done. But back to your original question, what else have we learned from last year's disasters? Evacuations take more time than you think. And so many people didn't realize it might take up to 22 hours to get from A to B, and they ran out of fuel. And one poor dear lady, I don't know if you remember about this, but she died in her car.
Wow.
It was so dreadfully hot there, but they couldn't use their air conditioning because they couldn't spare the fuel.
Well, and we get so used to knowing that services are there. Case in point, you turn on your faucet and there's your water and things like that, that when they stop, you can't handle it.
It's a shock. Something else that people found out in a rather rude way was that they didn't have a way to go to the bathroom. They, you know, they didn't anticipate.
Another thing you take for granted, Holly. You're absolutely right. I mean, nobody in modern day America, I should say nobody, there are some people, but you know, people aren't used to the old outhouse routine.
No, and where are you going to go when you've got, you know, a million onlookers on the same, you know, freeway with you? The other thing,
but there is a solution to that, though, isn't there?
Yes, and we will talk about that. Also, with this unpredictability, you don't have to have a Cat 5 hurricane to have a disaster. You know, when they looked at it again, Katrina ended up being only a 3.
Well, you know what? You're absolutely right. They thought that was, it just happened to hit in the wrong place.
That's exactly right. Something else people should remember is you need lots of cash. When I say lots of cash, I mean, you know, have a couple $100. If you're going to evacuate, don't think checks are going to work. Don't think credit cards
are going to work. Well, and your ATMs might not work, so you better have it in advance, right?
That's right. And the most important lesson is don't depend on FEMA or any other agency to come to your aid.
What kind of a grade, Holly, would you give FEMA for all the disasters that we've faced in the last year or so in terms of the way they've handled it? Let's take New Orleans out of the picture for just a moment, because that was an F. But how about all the other ones?
When James Witt was the director, I think FEMA really had its act more together than what we have seen in a long while. He had initiated Project Impact, and that was centering on people being prepared. That somehow went away, and we got the ineffectual Brown in there that couldn't find his way out of a paper bag. And people died.
He was so concerned about the clothes he was wearing.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
Like, we really care.
Stan, let me ask you this. You know, we're talking about, and we're going to talk tonight, about preparedness, and we've talked about earth changes. But I haven't brought up something that is equally, if not more so, dangerous for all of us, and that's a man-made calamity, a disaster. You know, we're talking about, for example, disarming Iran of its nuclear capabilities. Who knows what's going to happen there? Who knows? But there's still a lot of problems on this planet. We do know that terrorists are looking for radiological or smaller type nuke bombs. What happens, Stan, God forbid, if something like this happens?
On American soil?
On American soil.
Well, I think it's not if, I think it's when. Even Homeland Security says the same thing. Everyone's trying to do what they can to hold it off, but
And I think they're doing a real good job. They're just not publicizing it.
That's exactly it. Sadly, they cannot tell you what they've been doing because it tells the terrorists, the future terrorists, how to get around them.
Right. And also panics people.
Well,
you know, our buddy Steve Quayle comes on the program, and he's got very valuable information. Doug Hagman, who's doing better,
yep.
He has valuable information. But these are scary, scary events. I even weigh, Stan. I sit back and I say, look, there's a role here to play. Do we want to scare people with the truth or not tell them anything? And I always get to the point where I say, you know what? We got to tell them the truth. American people at least can accept it. I feel like you did when you were talking about, do you tell people about the possibility that we're going to have a major earthquake? If you don't, and you really believe it was going to happen, I think you're guilty, you're responsible for that.
Well, I think we have to give credit to folks, to Americans, that they have some rational, you know, bones in their body here. I mean, we have to treat them like adults, even though we know a lot of them don't act that way at the moment. When a crisis does hit, you'd be surprised how many people do swing into the adult mode, you know, the rational mode. And there's also a number of them that go into the criminal mode, but what I'm really concerned about, so Steve and Doug, is the situation in Iran, because, as you know, we're all students of biblical prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like reading the tactical moves of the countries involved in this time 100 years ahead of time.
It's like they're reading the book of Revelation going, well, I think we need to do this verse now.
Well, yeah.
It's uncanny the way some of these world events follow that prophecy.
Well, look at it. Yeah, look at the situation at the moment. Russia has told Iran, all right, we're pulling our people out of there because, you know, you're violating the nuclear treaty. You're taking the seals off your nuclear research sites. And, by the way, I think the United States is pretty irritated with you. We see Bush meeting with the new chancellor of Germany, and that only happens, you know, these little private tete-a-tetes happens when we need to use Germany as a staging area for our bombers and other things to go over into the Middle East. And from various sources, we know that there's an air wing that's already headed over that way. It's probably been there a couple of days now. And this guy, the Mahmoud, the president of Iran, is going to stir up enough trouble there that either Israel or the United States is going to make a preemptive strike. Now, Israel's done it to them before, years ago, when they put a nuclear reactor together. So
that was in Iraq.
Iraq.
That was
yeah.
in Iraq. Okay.
But they have a track record of going and making a preemptive strike on nuclear development. And so with Syria and Iran being allied to Russia and doing arms trading with them, and we know they have defense treaties as well, if either Syria and or Iran are attacked by the United States and or Israel, then Russia will be forced to come down and honor that treaty and bring troops down in great number to probably to Israel to strike at the heart of the alleged enemy of Islam.
Now, isn't this a catch-22, and we're building up to why we need to be prepared here. Isn't this a catch-22 because when you have the president of this republic in Iran talking about annihilating another country, if they get close to having these kinds of capabilities where they get a nuclear weapon, then God knows what he's going to do with it. What do you do, Stan? I mean, do you react now? Do you take them out? Do you try diplomacy? I mean, I don't understand when they talk about UN sanctions. What sanctions? How's that going to stop them?
It's not going to stop me. It's useless. And you know that there have been a number of suitcase nukes go missing after the Soviet Union broke apart.
Right.
And now then, of course, there's a thriving trade in the black market for arms.
You probably have some Soviet generals with hundreds of millions of dollars in Swiss bank accounts now.
Probably. But now, if you're Ahmadinejad, the Mohammed guy, Mahmoud guy, sorry, over in Iran, and you're going to stir up a fight to take out Israel, you know that the United States has its troops, et cetera, in Iraq. It's got a presence there. It's got a presence in Europe and Germany. And they'll stomp the life out of him if he tries. So why would he be so bold and say all these things? I think he's got a plan in place with the terrorists, because they certainly a lot of them live there, that he's got these terrorists planted all over the United States, ready to hit major cities with nukes and possibly with the biowarfare. And he's
if anything, radiological.
Pardon?
If anything, radiological.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, if they only hit one of our cities, like New York, say a bomb, dirty or otherwise, a nuclear bomb, went off close enough to Wall Street to melt it down, even though there are backup systems and data stored elsewhere in the world to bring the Wall Street trading back online, the shock, the panic in the consumers, the people that own the shares in the markets of the world, would be so great that there would be pandemonium.
You'd have to stop trading. You could not allow trading because you get an 11,000 Dow would go down to 1,000 points in a week.
Well, it would be absolute just pandemonium. There would be unemployment. There would be riots in the streets. There would be people just running around totally confused over one little city.
Let's talk about preparedness next with Stan Deo, Holly Deo. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.